Hi, this is David Wilk. I'm the host of Publishing Talks, a podcast about the publishing industry. Today I'm talking to Matt Bell. He's editor at DeZank Books. Because you can't, because you're hearing this and not necessarily seeing it, it's spelled D as in David, Z, A-N-C, C as in Charlie, Books. Hi, Matt. How are you?
I'm good. How about yourself?
I'm well. So tell me about DeZank Books, you know, the history, a little bit about the history, how, you know, what it started, how did it start, what was the motivating reason for beginning this publishing entity, and then, you know, maybe talk a little bit about how it's evolved, because I really want to get to asking you some questions about, you know, what the things are that you're doing today.
Sure. DeZank started, I believe, in 2006 as a literary nonprofit to do both literary fiction publishing, as well as community outreach. We published our first book in October of 2007, which was Roy Kesey's short story collection, All Over. And since then, I've published between 6 and 8 books a year through our own publishing, as well as another, I would say, 20 through our various imprints, so other small presses that work with us.
Well, so tell me a little bit, you know, the structure. When you say nonprofit, are you a 501c3 federally recognized charity where people can give you money and get, you know, a tax benefit from it?
Yes, absolutely. And we do that partly because at least half of our time is spent with some sort of community outreach programs, either assisting literary magazines, some of which have become imprints of ours. We have a writing in residence program where we send professional writers in to teach in public schools. That was actually the first thing I did for DeZank. I worked in a 4th and 5th grade classroom for 3 years as a writer-in-residence before I came on as an editor.
So, well, you know, it was, is there a physical location? I mean, obviously, I know that there are people who are involved with DeZank that are not all in the same physical location. So, you know, on some level, it's a virtual entity. But is there a physical home base, a place where there's an office and, you know, DeZank actually has a name on the door or anything like that?
There's not, actually. Most of the DeZank mailing is done out of Dan Wickett's office, but the rest of us all work from home and work separately, although me, Dan, and Steve are all in the Ann Arbor, Detroit area, and so we see each other reasonably frequently. We don't have a central office, which, you know, is interesting but increasingly unnecessary for a lot of the things we do. There are certainly tasks that probably would be easier if we saw each other every day, but a lot of it hasn't been kind of a big impact on the company.
Well, and so it, is it, do you feel, well, when it was it founded with that idea that there wouldn't be, you know, because often, you know, you think about nonprofits, whether they're literary or otherwise, where, you know, the impulse is to have a physical base as a way, it's almost like a physical representation of the organization, not even because you need it, but because it helps raise money, you know, if you have a physical building. So was, but your sense, it seems like it was built from the beginning to be something different.
Yeah, I think my understanding of the thinking behind that decision is that we could waste money on things like a physical office space or, you know, spending $1,000 on rent for a place for, you know, at the time it was just Dan and Steve, for two people to sit next to each other at a desk, instead of using that money on publishing books or promoting books or doing some of our other programs. And I think the idea from the very beginning was that not having some of that overhead would keep us more nimble than companies that are forced to.
Right. No, that makes sense. I mean, obviously, there's a huge benefit to keeping overhead low. And so what kind of places, you know, where do you go to raise money for DeZank, for all these, you know, for the different things that you do?
Sure. I mean, there's a combination of things. We have, obviously, money comes in through the book publishing. And we also have a series of fundraisers. Right now, we're promoting a fundraiser we have called DeZank Day, which on April 9th will be, I think, about 25 creative writing workshops all across the country that professional authors and editors have volunteered to teach for us, that people can go for between 2 and 4 hours for like $30. And then that money has been donated by the workshop leaders to help pay for some of the, like the writers in residence programs. We also have a program called Creative Writing Sessions. We have volunteer writers who work one-on-one with people over the internet. who might not have access to more traditional modes of creative writing instruction or mentoring. And that also helps, you know, bring in financial support and, you know, person at a time. And of course, we're always, you know, doing larger scale fundraising as well, although that's, you know, harder to talk about in some ways. It's a less visible program, maybe.
Well, do you get grants from any federal or state, you know, the agencies that support the arts, or do you stay away from those?
We are in the process of seeking support from grants as well. Absolutely, I mean, I think that's a valuable part of the arts in America and literary publishing in the nonprofit realm. So,
well, it seems like, you know, it's grown considerably. I mean, it's grown really a lot and has gotten a lot of support. You know, what it's sort of interesting to to see that happen kind of organically and almost. And do you feel like it's because what the Zank does is needed, particularly, you know, that a lot of writers are willing to support you?
You know, I think one of the things we come out of as a background is Dan Wickett, who's one of the co-founders, ran something called the Emerging Writers Network and still does, starting, I think, in 2003, although it might have even been earlier than that, where he was blogging about books they liked and writing book reviews online. And he's not a writer himself, so he's doing this purely as a reader and as someone who wanted to support sort of the arts community. And so by the time we started to Zank, he already had this sort of large base of people that he had supported and helped out and had all these relationships with people. And Steve had similar relationships, you know, through working as a writer for the last 10 years. And I think that goodwill they had genuinely generated in the world helped start to Zank off on the right foot. You know, people wanted to succeed from the beginning. People trusted us with their books before we'd published any books. We were lucky to have great people right away. You know, the first two books were Roy Kesey and Yannick Murphy. Both their books had stories in Best American the year their books came out. The people who were very successful and certainly didn't have to give their books to a brand new press. And I think some of that goodwill that Dan and Steve had generated made those things possible.
Well, it's, you know, it's pretty admirable, I think, that you've been able. Now, I got to ask you, what is the origin of the word Zank? How did that get invented? What does it mean? Why? You know, why is it there?
Zank is the first initials of Dan and Steve's kids.
Ah, okay.
See? Well,
yeah, that's cool. That works.
So, and that's part of the reason, of course, why it has, you know, people have trouble pronouncing it. That it doesn't have a pre-existing meaning.
Right. No, I think that's true. It looks, I think I said this to you once before, that it looks like a Eastern European, you know, that it was somebody from, you know, Lithuania or Romania or something, you know, that it's named after. But obviously, it's more creative than that.
Right.
So, well, one of the things that I've noticed is that you have all kinds of programs. I mean, you've got the Emerging Writers Network. You have Disquiet, the International Literary Program. You have a Writer in Residence program. You have Creative Writing Sessions. You have the Collagist. There's the Zank Prize. So maybe you could talk a little bit about how these things all fit together, and particularly what's the Zank Prize.
The Zank Prize is not necessarily a short story competition, but a competition that has a couple of parts. And what we ask people to submit is a manuscript in progress, not something that's done, but something they're working on, and then some sort of literary community service plan. The first person who won it was Laura Vandenberg, who submitted part of her short story collection, as well as a plan to teach creative writing in prisons, I believe. And we've also since then done other programs in hospitals and that sort of thing. And so the idea is that it would be two things, that it would celebrate someone who is not only a great writer, but also a citizen in their community, and that we would provide support not only for their work in progress, but also for their efforts to better the place that they're from and to further creative writing in populations that maybe don't get those kind of opportunities. And I think that's been really successful. You know, we get a good number of applications every year, and it's always an interesting thing to go through and see the different things people are planning on doing or trying to do in their communities. And it's one way that we get to help communities maybe we wouldn't on our own because we aren't as, you know, closely in contact with them.
Right. No, I mean, it's all of your, it's almost like, you know, there's so many things that you do. It's very impressive, I think. You know, it's just amazing that you can keep all these balls in the air.
Well, you know, you know, it's, we're a very small company. I mean, there's only, in the core design group, there's only four of us right now. And then of course, you know, plenty of other people helping out and interns and that sort of thing. But you know, we work a lot of hours and we, you know, enjoy what we do and it means a lot to us. And so we put the time in to get these things done. You know, it doesn't mean, of course, we don't occasionally struggle because we do have a lot going on. But, you know, generally the work's enjoyable, and I think it means a lot to us to be this ambitious and to try to do these many things as opposed to having a more limited scope.
Right. No, I think it's – I sort of sympathize because I, you know, I feel like the more you do and the more variation you have, it's a way of keeping your interest up, but it also, you know, there are times when it can be stressful because things happen, you know, sometimes in waves.
Yes.
but at the same time, you know, I think that there's a benefit to that, to, you know, to a small operation because it forces you to do more.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really, you know, that's good. It probably is good for you to resist the impulse to add more people because I think as you get more people, sometimes the, you know, that intensity dissipates.
Right.
You know, it's better to say, you know, we'll just work really hard than it is to say, oh, we got to go out and hire some more people.
Yeah, that's definitely a quality of the group is sort of that all of us are maybe bad delegators and very good at working hard on something ourselves, you know,
right.
Which is probably the case in many small organizations, you know.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I think the impulse to start something and do it is different from the impulse to run an organization. You know, you have the impulse to get stuff to happen because you love, you know, I always looked at publishing books as a sort of extension of the same impulse that people have to write.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you want people to read this stuff that you really care about.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that is not the same impulse as somebody who wants to start a business and have 40 employees.
Right.
they're probably antithetical. So... now, but let me ask you also about the imprints that you have. You've got Black Lawrence, you have Dezank, Keyhole, Monkey Bicycle, Other Voices, and I guess it's Start Your One or Start Your Own?
Start Your Own.
Start Your Own. These are all, I think as I recollect, they're existing small publishers that you've brought in under your umbrella.
Yeah, and the way that works is a little different from imprint to imprint on how our relationship works. You know, some of them are our financial arrangements, some of them have more just due distribution. So it's different with every one of them. But the overarching idea is that these were presses and magazines that that we thought were great and that were doing really good work and that needed some form of assistance. And a lot of what we can provide is distribution. You know, we have a great distributor and lets books get into more places and have better access to readers. And so some of that's all we've done for some. But the biggest thing, I guess, to know about it is that we don't have any sort of editorial control over any of the imprints. We don't tell any of them who they should publish, how they should interact with their authors. That's all left to the presses themselves. You know, so that all these entities that pre-existed are just as editorially independent today as they were then. And so hopefully all we're adding is benefits and not getting in the way of the already great work they were doing.
That's cool. No, I think that's right, that you're essentially providing them with an umbrella, a service set,
mm-hmm.
not necessarily. I mean, and of course it makes sense. You want to retain their individual character and let them be what they are.
Mm-hmm.
Now most of the books you're publishing now, you'll do in print form and in ebook form. Is that correct?
Yeah, everything new will be in both, and everything that's already out will eventually be in ebook as well.
And so, you know, in the move to ebooks, what is your sense at this point in terms of, I assume you're doing all the formats, you know, I know in part because I subscribe to your book club, which is what I want to talk about next, but you distribute the ebooks in Kindle, which is .mobi, and EPUB formats. Also, I guess, in PDF, so people can download them directly from you if they don't have a reader.
Right. One of the things that was really important to me when I took over doing the ebooks, and now I'm the one who does all the coding for the ebooks, and I designed those myself rather than send them out or have them auto-converted. So I do every book from scratch. And one of the things that was really important to me was that they would be compatible on everything, that the books that we sold directly wouldn't have any digital rights management, that they, you know, you buy the book from us and you should be able to use it into the foreseeable future. You obviously can't give it to you in a format that doesn't exist yet, but we can cover you for what does, and try to, you know, not penalize readers for trying what's really a new technology, at least in a popular way. Obviously, e-readers have been around a long time, but their popular usage is only a couple years old, and, you know, we want to provide the best service we can for that. So I think that's the reason behind doing all the different formats. It's not that hard once you've done one to do the others, if it's hard at all. And so I think it just seemed like the right thing to do rather than ask people to get one format and then be mad the next year when they get a Nook instead of a Kindle and can't read the books they paid for.
Well, no, I think that's a good point, too. Two things you've said that I thought were important. One is that you're really treating the reader as your customer, no matter what, not penalizing them because they've chosen to read it in a particular form. You know, there is this issue in, you know, many venues, I'm sure you've heard about, but, you know, that the notion of the ebook is really a license, not sale.
Mm-hmm.
There are limitations aside from DRM, which is digital rights management, that some publishers feel strongly is there to protect, not necessarily against piracy, but to control the distribution of the ebook once it has been sold.
Right.
And I put quotation marks around sold.
Sure.
To a customer. And I don't even want to talk about the benefits or harmfulness of DRM here, but you've clearly taken the position of, you know, more or less the open source view, which is we're not going to try to control how the consumer consumes our product.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, something that we're less in control of when we put the books up on the Amazon site, or, you know, you sell them through iBooks, something like, they have sort of their own restrictions there. And I guess our way of mitigating that forced hand is to have the opposite take on ours, that, you know, that we want you to do with it what you want. We want you to feel like you bought it. You know, we appreciate people, you know, reading our books, and we're not out to penalize people. We're not trying to do the thing where you can't copy your CDs so that you'll buy it again on MP3, you know, like, we want you to enjoy what you bought.
I think that's important. You know, the conversations I've had the last couple of days have been around this issue of the fact that writers really want to be read.
Mm-hmm.
And writers, of course, want to be paid for their work. And that doesn't mean that every writer feels this way, but the general feeling of most writers is they would do anything to have a reader.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what they write for. That's why you write books, that you write them in order to have somebody can read what you wrote. So, of course, there has to be an exchange system. That's the world we live in. But, you know, I think if you ask most writers, they would want their publishers to take the position that you do, which is, wherever possible, to honor that relationship between the reader and the writer. I also noticed that you priced your ebooks at a very reasonable price. You know, you're at $7.99 for at least at most of the ones that I looked at, which I think is the right approach. Also, again, this is a point of big arguments among mm-hmm. publishers, but you've clearly taken the position that you're going to go for the, you know, what looks like a kind of trade or mass market paperback price point.
Yeah, I think Without maybe speculating too much about other people's business decisions, I think bigger presses are perhaps trying to protect their hardcover or print sales by pricing their ebooks above them.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, a popular new hardcover might cost $12.50 on Amazon after they discount it all the way down, and the ebook will be $12.99, and they're protecting their print sales rather than wanting you to buy the ebook. The ebook is there because they have to have it. And they would really prefer you bought the hardcover. And I think we recognize, I guess to us, the other part of it is that the print object is something extra to us. Like we do put a lot of time into the print quality and the cover and the you know, book as object. And so we recognize that that is something that's more expensive. You know, we do have paperbacks that are maybe a little bit more than our standard cost. But the ebook doesn't incur all those costs, you know, and we shouldn't pass them along to the reader when they don't exist.
Right.
We're not, we want you to read our books. We want you to try our authors. We're not in the business of determining how you do that as much as maybe other companies that are hedging their bets on formats are.
Do you feel in that context that the e-book reading experience, which is growing, obviously, do you feel, and again, I don't think there's any way to know for sure, but do you feel that that's growing a lot for you and that at the same time, is your print business declining or staying the same? You know, what's happening there?
I don't think we're experiencing a decline in print sales because of e-books. E-books are just starting to be a bigger part of our business. I think what we're doing is seeing that people are willing to try a book on ebook that maybe they wouldn't in print. And I think that it increases that sort of access, you know, that speed at which you can start reading an ebook from want to reading is so fast.
Yeah.
And having it there is great. One of the things I think that Amazon did brilliantly, and I think it's probably forced everyone else to do at this point, is that getting a sample of the book whenever you want to look at a new book.
Yeah.
Just having our books on Amazon so that people can dip into a new book of ours is, to me, already a fantastic benefit, you know?
No, I agree.
We're making the e-book so that all those samples of our books are there.
Right. I think, in fact, that is one of the key elements for a lot of people in the success of e-books, that is the that instantaneous gratification and the ability to go from sampling to buying, which you only could get otherwise by spending a whole lot of time browsing books in a bookstore.
Yeah, and even there you have that delay, right, where you're like, you have to stand in line, and then you sort of second-guess yourself. And
right,
it really is something to get to the end of that and want to know the next sentence and just click the link, you know?
Right. Well, and it's also true that if the ebook is less expensive, it does encourage that risk-taking that, you know, because when you buy a book, if it's, you know, you've read the first chapter in you're sitting in the aisle in the bookstore and you're really captivated by it, you go buy it and it costs you $20 or $22, and then you get home and maybe it wasn't so good, you know, you might feel a little bit more regret, but when you paid $7.99, you don't feel so bad if the book didn't quite turn out as well as you thought it would.
No, and it doesn't sit on your shelf staring at you either. But,
but then again, you can't go sell it for $4 at the, you know,
exactly,
used bookstore. So let's talk a little bit about the Zank Books eBook Club, because I think one of the things that is really interesting to me is for publishers and writers to figure out new ways of selling books. And, you know, because, you know, it's fairly commonly known that the traditional book market has got some challenges, shall we say. But it's hard for publishers, or it has been hard for publishers, to figure out what reasonably interesting things they can do to reach readers in new ways. And I thought the e-book club was really, really interesting. And I joined. You know, it's like,
yeah.
You offer 11 books for $50 is a pretty powerful driver for anybody who's interested in new fiction. You guys publish, you know, books that in many cases people may not have heard of your authors. They may not know these books. You know, even if you're kind of involved in, you know, literature and you follow the reviews, there are always going to be writers you don't know.
Well, absolutely.
It's like a great sampler for $50. It's not such a bad price. I thought it was really smart. So what's been your experience with this? You know, have you been getting a lot of people buying in?
Yeah, I think, you know, we had a really nice initial burst and people continue to join. I think the reception from people has been really great. You know, people are enjoying the books. They're working for their devices. They're reading books they wouldn't have. As you said, I think it's really easy with sort of especially even if you are a person who's really plugged into sort of like the literary scene and you're seeing all the stuff coming out and you're paying attention to the small presses, there's so much that comes out that, you know, I have presses that I would say like, oh, that's one of my favorite presses. I would read everything they put out and realize I haven't read any of their books in a year, you know?
Right.
Just because there's so much. And I think this is one way for, you know, the hardest part about being a small company or a small publisher is getting people to know you exist in the first place, to get people to know about your what you do and about your authors. And this is a really nice way for once someone finds out about us and likes what we do or is interested in what we do, for them to stay involved and to stay part of it and to read everything. And, you know, even if we're selling, you know, a book club member the books at a discount, the assumption is, A, that they're enjoying what they're reading and they're telling other people, and that that word of mouth is really good for us and other people will come join the ebook club or check out the individual books. So it's kind of been, I think, a great program for us. It's going really well, and hopefully the people joining feel the same way.
So, and how long has it been going? When did you start?
I believe it started in, I think we started in November. I think November was our first month.
So, Willie, and this is, I can't even remember now, but I assume it's like an annual deal, right? So, or whatever the period is, once I've gotten my 11 books, you're going to have to ask me to renew.
Yes, absolutely.
So I think that will be obviously a big moment for you. You'll get to find out how many people renew, how much, you know, commitment can you get from people. You know, it's sort of like magazines looking for renewals of subscriptions. You know, it's a real test. You know, it is definitely easier to keep the thing going that you've already done with it, because it's, you know, there's a certain inertia for the, you know, mm-hmm. me as a member. But I think, you know, some people may say, no, I don't want to do it, or I just didn't read enough of the books, or, you know, I can't afford $50 this time. But hopefully you'll find that the renewal rate will be really strong, and, you know, that will help you, I think. I mean, it does seem also like a kind of old, you know, in one way, like the old magazine theory is that when somebody sends you a subscription, they're essentially financing you in advance.
Yeah.
For publishing the future issues of the magazine, and that's happening with your books as well. I mean, I'm essentially giving you $4.50 in advance for books that I have no idea even exist.
Right, no, I think that's absolutely right. You know, there's an element of faith to that that happens with anything like that. I mean, even though when I was younger, I did like the Columbia Records Club, right?
Right.
And I had to like believe that they were going to send me stuff I wanted to read, but it's so it's or to listen to. So it's a model that I think people are fairly familiar with, and that for us seems good. I think the big maybe problem with it right now is sort of like the delivery mechanism, which I would love to see smoothened. You know, it's just maybe just hard with everybody having different devices.
Right.
You know, because obviously one of the things is that not every person who uses an e-reader is comfortable yet with downloading files and sideloading them onto their device instead of just
right.
going to Amazon having it show up there.
So do you have to? You end up doing a fair amount of technical assistance to people who are your customers?
Almost none, but I think it maybe prevents some people from joining.
Oh, I see what you mean, because they're afraid that it won't work easily for them, so they don't try it.
Right.
So maybe
that's the big problem with everyone selling ebooks directly right now, is that it's just not as easy as getting it from Amazon, you know?
Right. Well, though I found, now I, you know, I haven't explored, you know, I haven't experimented with every reader that I have. You know, I've got a bunch of readers on the iPad, I've got a Kindle, what I've been doing is sideloading into my iBookstore.
Mm-hmm.
And I must admit, it is true. When I first did it, it's clunky. It's not really the best methodology for getting a book into your reader. You know, that you download it, then you have to move it into iTunes, then you have to sync it with your device.
Right.
That seems to me less than ideal. I think, you know, in the best of all possible worlds, I would put it in my iBookstore on the computer, and it would automatically sync. I wouldn't have to. I mean, everything else automatically syncs. Why not that?
Are you using an iPad?
Yes.
On yours, you could open them directly from your email, and you put it right into iBooks.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. But in order to get it into the iPad, I actually have to sync the book to
right.
the bookstore on the iPad. And that's the part, I think, unless I'm doing it wrong, but I think that's the part that I think Apple probably could do better. It's not your fault, but it's, you know, it's sort of those kinds of things. I think we're so used now to the smoothness of what we were just talking about before, you know, how easy it is with Amazon. If you have a Kindle, it really is a no-brainer.
It's one of the places that differs weirdly from music, you know, where I think we're all really used to the idea of, like, downloading music on our computer, putting it in iTunes, syncing it to our device. But somehow doing the same thing with books feels wrong because Amazon set up that first populist workflow as direct.
Yeah.
You can download music directly to your iPod. I don't know anyone who does it.
Right.
You know? Like, it's just like a weird thing where that was the flow we all learned, and we're sticking with it, you know?
No, that's true. And that's probably why Apple did this with iBooks as well.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense. Well, you know, I admire you for the creative energy that led you to start the ebook club. I really hope it succeeds. Maybe this issue of, you know, people's fear of or reticence to do the technical work, maybe that's an opening for you, though. You know, maybe that's sort of your backwards sales pitch. You know, the way you think about the 60s ads for Volkswagens made light of the fact that they were different from, you know, the Chevys, the Fords, the Buicks of the time. So maybe that's your trick is going to be, you know, yes, it does require a little effort to read our books, but you're only paying us $4.50 a book.
So you could afford to spend $3 worth of effort on each one.
That's right. You know, it's like, hey, we just saved you $35. Could you please sideload?
Right.
Learn how to do it.
I mean, that's even a bad term, though. I mean, it sounds like something, like you're doing something shady to the device, you know?
I know, that's true. Well, maybe you have to come up with new terms. I mean, as you know, the words matter. So,
yeah.
You know, you're right. It probably, maybe you invent call it the Zank Loader, you know?
Right, exactly. Like a special program to sideload your software for you.
That's right. No, I think that would...
But, you know, the people who signed up haven't had any problems, and it's going to get more and more common. I think the first MP3 players, nobody understood how to use them. You know, I think there's still a huge market of cheap devices that don't really work, that people sort of just like haul around and don't understand why people are so excited about iPods, you know. And this will be the same way. It might not happen tomorrow, but already, you know, it's getting so commonplace that people are getting more and more comfortable with the devices. And that particular concern, I think, will fade rapidly.
No, I think you're right. So are you able to track the devices that people are reading on once you, I mean, this, again, I know this is, there are three different ways you can be selling. One is you sell direct, and then I put it in whatever device I'm reading on. And then the other way is you have, you know, your direct relationship with Amazon, your direct relationship with Apple, and your relationship with, you know, Barnes & Noble for Nook and Sony. What's your feel of the distribution of readership? Is it, you know, is it more Amazon for Kindle than anything else or what?
You know, I don't have a honest sense myself that I've actually, not being the numbers guy for the company, haven't looked at that. But I would say that my anecdotal sense among the kind of readers we have is that most people are using Kindles or the Kindle app on their iPads.
Right.
Which is also the combination that I use as well. I think so many of us who are the early adopter types got Kindles when that blew up, and we sort of got stuck in that ecosystem. You know, one of the reasons to use the Kindle app on my iPad is because that's where my books are, you know. Although I guess I do prefer it to other software anyway, but I think those things are going to matter for a long time. I think iBooks has some work to do to beat that, and certainly the other ones as well.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. It's also... you know, there's a certain, I mean, I don't know this for sure, but guessing that because Amazon is identified as a book company,
yes,
that an Apple is, you know, self-identifies as something different, even though they care about books and they promote them, Amazon is book-centric.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes sense that a readership would be more... drawn to the Kindle and the Kindle app. You know, I guess that makes sense.
I think also some of the things that help is that, I don't know if you find yourself doing this, but I know myself and a lot of friends do, is that I often use Amazon just as a place to look up books.
Sure.
Everything's there. So, like, you mention a new novel to me, and I'll look on Amazon just to see it, like, or an old book, or I'm trying to find out about some author I've never heard about. That we use it as sort of this like Wikipedia-like book place.
Right.
And I think being the go-to place in everybody's mind for that has really helped. Where like iBooks, you can't even look at online. You can't tell what they have unless you go into your app. And, you know, so they have these sort of like different mental workflows and how we look for books and how we engage with books. The Amazon so far is I think winning. I can't remember ever trying to find out about a book on Barnes & Noble, even if I would eventually buy it there, you know?
Right. No, I
not
think
first
a,
place.
Right. It's a fair point that the first place, you know, the number one is usually number one by a big margin, almost becomes branded in people's minds. You know, Amazon equals books online in the same way.
Right.
Barnes & Noble won the bricks and mortar battle and became, you know, Barnes & Noble is what a lot of people thought of as a bookstore. You know, it's what, you know, like when people thought of rental cars, they would say Hertz.
Right.
And the number two, whoever that would be at that particular time, was, you know, less visible. It was not branded in the same way, even though they might have been really good. So I think you're right. I think Amazon has mind share. And you're right also, this idea that it's a resource now for all sorts of things that people are involved, who are involved in reading will go to, does kind of mean that you're going to end up living there. So it makes it more natural to migrate to their devices and their software for reading. I think that's
yeah.
true.
It's a complicated thing, you know, because obviously Amazon has a lot of effects on the business for good and bad. So those things are always, as much use as I make of them, you know, it's a complicated relationship, you know, I think. But, you know, overall, I think for ebooks at least, Amazon is the one who got the party going. I mean, the Sony readers have been around for a long time. You could do it on your desktop for a long time. But the Kindle made it something that the average person could do. And I think that's a benefit for everybody. I'm a big supporter of the ebook and enjoy reading ebooks. And I think that, you know, what they got going is something that I'm pretty excited about. And I think is a good thing for us as an industry and a good thing for small publishers, especially.
Yeah, no, I agree. Well, so before we go, I just want to mention, because I think people should know, that you're also a writer, and you have a book called How They Were Found, which is on the DeZank Books website. I just wanted to mention that because I think it's important. You know, it looks like everybody, well, at least not everybody, but most of the people involved in DeZank are also writers.
Yeah, for the most part. Not everybody, but a lot of us. Dan Wicked isn't at all. Steve is, and I am. But Steven Sigmund, who does our design, is not. I think all the imprint editors are, but it depends a little bit. I think one of the nice things about that is that so many of us have had, you know, our publishing experiences as writers, and that we take those and apply them to the way we treat our you know, authors, is that, you know, we know what we wanted when we were being published and when we were working with editors and that sort of thing, and we just try to replicate the best of those experiences for our own writers.
Right. So essentially, that makes you like a writer's press, which I think is pretty valuable. Well, I really appreciate your taking some time to talk to me. This has been Publishing Talks, a podcast about the book industry. I'm David Wilk, your host. I've been talking to Matt Bell of DeZank Books and many other, components of the DeZank empire. So thanks a lot, Matt. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate talking to you.
Take care.